It is Monday, January the 8th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, U.S. messages for North Korea.
The U.S. is trying very hard to send North Korea a stern message. I think the U.S. feels a bit cornered by recent developments.
Also ahead, operations in Syria to take all of Idlib province, legalizing marijuana, plus the sounds of the platters. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. President Trump says he hopes the newly arranged talks between North and South Korea will go beyond the Olympics.
I hope they do. I would love to see them take it beyond the Olympics. We have a very good relationship with South Korea. I would love to see it go far beyond the Olympics. Absolutely. And at the appropriate time, we'll get involved.
The president also said he had spoken with South Korean leader Moon Jae-in, who thanked Mr. Trump for his tough stance regarding North Korea. Meantime, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, appearing on the ABC program this week, spoke about tweets by President Trump coming back at North Korean leader Kim Jong-un about having a button on his desk to set off a nuclear attack.
What they know is we're not letting up on the pressure. We're not going to let them go and dramatize the fact that they have a button right on their desk and that they can destroy America. We want to always remind them we can destroy you too. So be very cautious and careful with your words and what you do.
CIA Director Mike Pompeo appeared on Fox News Sunday, where he spoke about the U.S. message to Pyongyang.
The North Koreans are in a tough spot. President Trump has made very clear that the U.S. policy is denuclearization of the peninsula and that we're going to achieve that. So you see the North Koreans doing what they have historically done, reaching out, trying to find space, trying to come up for air when they're being strangled by a president who's made very clear that their behavior is unacceptable.
And for some perspective on all of this, VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with Tufts University Korean Studies professor Soon-Yun Lee.
The U.S. is trying very hard to send North Korea a stern message. I think the U.S. feels a bit cornered by recent developments. Kim Jong-un, of course, took a very conciliatory, although I would term that quasi, fake conciliatory tone during his New Year's address. And South Korea now is all excited over the prospect of participation in the Winter Olympic Games starting 1 month from now in South Korea by North Korean athletes and possibly North Korean cheerleaders. And of course, it makes sense for North Korea to try to drive a wedge between the U.S. and South Korea, its ancient Chinese strategy using barbarians against barbarians. So I think the U.S. feels a bit wary that South Korea may be overexcited and prone to giving all kinds of concessions to the North. And I think the U.S. is a bit also a bit wary that North Korea feels confident that it is in the driver's seat.
CIA Director Pompeo said North Korea appears to be being strangled by President Trump's policy. This is the reason why it agreed to hold official talks this week scheduled with South Korea. Do you agree with that?
Not necessarily. I think that's the right approach to continually send a strong message to North Korea. At the same time, I think North Korea really sees itself as the proactive party armed with both the carrot and stick. And early 2018 is an ideal time for North Korea to de-escalate a bit, especially after that successful banner ballistic year last year, and to change the dynamics and to reach out to South Korea and to try to gain a lot of concessions from the South. In the past, South Korea has really gone overboard to placate, to appease North Korea during the 2000s when North Korea was sending athletes and hundreds of cheerleaders to the South. During those heady times, over $1 billion worth of cash, food and fuel and other blandishments flowed from South Korea to North Korea, no questions asked. And it will take a lot for the current South Korean administration to go back to those norms today. But South Korea has been showing signs that it really will pay for everything, will bend over backwards for North Korea's participation in the Winter Olympic Games. The governor of Gangwon province, for example, the site of the Olympic Games, has publicly said that he would send a luxury cruise ship to transport North Korean athletes and officials. He is all for a joint North Korea-South Korea Olympic team, ice hockey, figure skating, and so on, which, of course, is absurd because that would mean that South Korean athletes who had been training hard and had gained the qualifications to compete, some of them would be sidelined. So these are the strange developments in inter-Korean dynamics that I think make the United States a little concerned.
President Trump indicated Saturday he's prepared to talk with North Korea about tensions over its nuclear and missile programs. Is this the right time to talk?
I don't think so. And I think the signs coming out of the government by all the principals, the CIA director and the Secretary of State and so forth, are that we'll see. We'll just wait and see. When President Trump spoke with President Moon just a few days ago, in the wake of that phone conversation, the statements coming out of Seoul and Washington were rather different. The White House issued a statement saying that the two leaders agreed to, quote, continue the campaign of maximum pressure against North Korea and not repeat the mistakes of the past, end quote. Whereas South Korea said that President Trump lent his full support for North-South talks that are scheduled to begin in about 24 hours. There was no mention of maximum pressure or not repeating the mistakes of the past. So the United States is understandably a little concerned, but it cannot come out and say so in public that it is viewing its ally, South Korea, with a skeptical eye.
As the ministerial talks get underway between North and South Korea, presumably at the Panmunjom DMZ site, there are indications from monitoring websites and satellite imagery that the North may be preparing a new rocket engine test, perhaps a new solid fuel engine for its missiles this year during these talks or about the time of these talks. Is that a growing concern to you?
It is. And North Korea, of course, has a systemic need to continue to conduct those tests. And here's a question for you and our listeners. If North Korea were to say today, which is Kim Jong-un's birthday, or any time in the coming days, to conduct another ICBM test or a nuclear test, that completely derailed the beginnings of inter-Korean dialogue? I don't think so. Just merely by pretending to be interested in reconciliation, Kim Jong-un effectively has won an insurance policy against forceful reaction by the United States in the wake of the next provocation, which will happen any time. If North Korea were to do a provocation tomorrow, South Korea would say, oh no, the danger of war has arisen again. We had a chance to reach out to North Korea. We were beginning to make progress on real substantive talks on de-escalation, so we must not give that up. So North Korea has bought itself a waiver, if you will, against its next provocation just by reaching out to South Korea.
Soon-Yun Lee, professor of Korean studies at Tufts University, he was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. Syrian government forces and allied militiamen are advancing on the largest remaining rebel-held territory in the country's north, forcing thousands of civilians to flee toward the border with Turkey in freezing winter temperatures. The offensive on Idlib, a large province in northwestern Syria packed with civilians dominated by al-Qaeda-linked militants, was expected after the defeat of the Islamic State group late last year. Last week, Russia's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov said the main military operations against IS in Syria have ended and signaled that the focus would shift to the al-Qaeda-linked militants. We asked University of New South Wales Mideast lecturer Anthony Billingsley if this is a new chapter in Syria's long and bloody civil war.
I think it's an inevitable step. I don't think we should be surprised by it. Assad would be wanting to regain control, as much of the country as he possibly can. And so this is a logical step. It secures his control over access to Aleppo. It also presents a bit of a challenge to the Turks, who have been demonstrating quite a bit of interest in, well, dominating the northern part of Syria for their own interests. So, there's a lot of reasons why they would do that.
The sort of operation does have some risks, mainly because of the heavy population of civilians and the fact that destruction and displacement could be high as well. We asked Professor Billingsley about this being the last thing that the region needs.
Well, it is, and certainly the last thing the people need, but I don't think the government will be, or the Russians will be concerned by that. Their objective is to regain the territory, and as we've seen elsewhere in the country during the fighting, the government hasn't felt concerned to avoid civilian casualties or at least the movement of refugees. So I don't think the government will be concerned by that at all.
We also asked Professor Billingsley about the push on Idlib province and concerns it could be bloody.
Well, that's right. A sort of reflection of what happened in Iraq and Mosul, I suspect. In a lot of cases, we've had deals between the government and opposition forces where the opposition would pull out of a particular town and the forces would move with their families towards places like Idlib. And so you have this growing concentration of, and as you say, very often battle-hardened and skilled fighters. And we can see that this has been going on, as with Ghouta, close to Damascus. This has been going on for almost the length of the war, and the government hasn't been able to overtake them yet. But I think that what we'll see is probably a similar pattern to what we've seen elsewhere with Russian bombing and barrel bombs from the Syrians and that sort of thing as a way of softening the place up.
That is University of New South Wales Middle East lecturer Anthony Billingsley. Also in the news, a recent announcement the U.S. Justice Department made rescinds its hands-off approach to states here in the United States that have legalized marijuana. Initially, it sent some in the industry into a bit of a tailspin just days after California's $7 billion recreational marijuana market opened for business. Here's VOA's Kevin Enix.
This is the line outside the MedMen Medical Marijuana Dispensary. All these people are waiting to legally buy recreational pot for the first time.
Oh, it's a historic moment. We were in line for an hour and a half, and I think it's great that I'm able to come in and do this today. It's a great day.
On January 1st, California became the sixth U.S. state to legalize the recreational use of marijuana, though it is still a federal crime to use, buy, or possess marijuana. But as the world's sixth largest economy and home to nearly 40 million people, the sheer size of the state is a game changer for the move to legalize pot.
It feels great buying marijuana for the first time. It's a win for human rights, the ability to have freedom to do what you want and express yourself and also have a good time.
Each locality has a complicated set of rules for starting up new businesses, and a number of California cities haven't yet finalized them for creating marijuana shops. But those that are up and running are busy, and the state's marijuana economy is expected to be worth several billion dollars.
This is what it's all about. I mean, this is the first day of legal recreational sales in the city of West Hollywood. There's a line of about 150 people outside. We're at capacity inside per the fire marshal, and as you can see, I mean, the excitement around legal adult marijuana is it's evident.
While California residents wait for businesses to catch up with the demand, they may grow their own very limited and very private supply of the psychoactive plant. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
And now it's time for a look at what's trending on social media. VOA's Doug Bernard here with What's Happening.
Well, there's really three things, I think, that's getting a lot of attention out there on social media. First of all, those politically inclined are certainly talking a lot about this new book by author Michael Wolff, the book Fire and Fury. It's a look inside the first year of the Trump White House. It is not necessarily very flattering portrait that's portrayed. There's lots of discussion back and forth, whether people believe Michael Wolff, whether people believe Donald Trump, whether people believe Steve Bannon, all this kind of in and out. And that's something I think that's going to be with us for a while. So I thought we would at least pass over that for the time being. The second item is a lot of the tech heads, the nerds, I guess, are talking about a really major story. You may have heard of this. There is a bug variously called either Spectre or Meltdown. And this bug or flaw is found in nearly every one of the semiconductor chips, those all-important chips that make our computers, our tablets, our phones, basically everything electronic like that work. Well, there's a big vulnerability in those. And essentially what security people are saying is this makes almost every digital product out there vulnerable to hacking. Another story that we're going to be hearing about a lot, I think, and it's very technical, so it's hard to get into. There is a third story, however, that I guess just a lot of the rest of us are talking about, at least in the United States. It's going to get very cold. There is a polar vortex that is swooping on down, and by very cold, I'm talking about 20 below Fahrenheit, 30 below, maybe 40 below degrees Fahrenheit. So very cold. In fact, the hashtag out there, It's So Cold, is trending right now. And I thought I'd just read a couple of the posts in social media. Hashtag It's So Cold. I saw a dude walking his dog from the car. It's so cold, my elf set fire to the shelf. It's so cold, the snowman in the front yard knocked on the door and asked if he could come inside and sleep on the sofa. These sound like bad late-night jokes. Hashtag It's So Cold that Steve Bannon's multiple shirts seem like a good idea. And how about this one? It's so cold, Starbucks is serving coffee on a stick. So those are just some of the ways I think that people are kind of just trying to deal with a very, very uncomfortable situation. And that's a bit of a peek into social media today.
Coffee on a stick, I can't imagine. Hey, listen, at my desk here at VOA, it's about 32 degrees Fahrenheit. Pretty chilly out there. Many thanks, Doug. VOA's Doug Bernard. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Are you someone who performs random acts of kindness for other people? A person walking in front of you drops a bag of groceries and its contents spill out everywhere. You instinctively stoop down and help the other gather up the dropped items. It's just a natural human impulse. New research from Duke University now suggests that we're not the only species that displays such altruistic behavior. It turns out bonobos, a group of primates from Africa's Congo Basin, will go out of their way to help strangers without being asked to do so. While studying bonobos who were born in the wild, the researchers found that the small apes will help another get food even when their efforts aren't reciprocated. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. It is time now for a little something from the world of music.
When the twilight is gone, ah, and no songbirds are singing, ah, when the twilight is gone, ah, you come into my heart, and here in my heart you will stay while I pray.
my prayer is to linger with you.
The Platters is an American vocal group formed in 1952. They were one of the most successful vocal groups of the era and remain popular even now with fan access through social media and downloads.
My prayer is a rapture in blue with the world far away and your lips close to mine. May they still be the same.
The Platters went through several changes in singers, with the most successful comprising lead singer Tony Williams, as well as David Lynch, Paul Robey, Herb Reed, and Zola Taylor. The group had dozens of charting singles on the Billboard Hot 100 chart between 1955 and 1967, including four number one hits. My Prayer was among them. So was Smoke Gets in Your Eyes.
They ask me how I knew my true love was true. Someday you'll find all who love are blind. Oh, when your heart's on fire, you must realize smoke gets in your eyes.
The Platters were one of the first African-American groups to be accepted as a major group and were, for a period of time, the most successful vocal ensemble in the world.
Yet today, my love has flown away.
And as I mentioned earlier, the group's lineup changed many times, and there were numerous legal challenges among the many groups of Platters. In fact, the latest lineup of the Platters is out on the road right now, singing to sold-out venues wherever they go. They always have many of the original songs on their playlist, songs like The Magic Touch, which went to the top of the charts more than 60 years ago.
You've got the magic touch. Ooh. It makes me glow so much. Ooh. It casts a spell. Ooh.
rings a bell, the magic touch. Oh, when I feel your charm, it's like a four-alarm. You make me thrill so much. You've got the magic touch.
It's really amazing that a group that had its origins 65 years ago and still in various incarnations out on the road now to sold out houses. I think it's amazing. Singing the same kind of music, so there you go. Thanks everyone for listening to The Voice of America today, an international edition. Always good to have you with us. Top World News is straight ahead. For our director Tracy Carter and engineer Greg Burns, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Monday. And now a bit more of The Platters.
Here I go, really. Oh, oh, I'm feeling the glow. Oh, oh. But where can I go from you? I didn't know too much, and then I felt your touch, and now I've learned I can return the magic touch.
Do, do, do.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The administration of President Donald Trump has placed a focus on women's economic opportunities, empowerment, and entrepreneurship. That's because even though there is no better way to strengthen the economy than to boost women's participation in the workforce, still too often women face barriers to success. One persistent problem is women's lack of access to digital technology, said USAID's Senior Coordinator for Gender Equality and Women's Empowerment, Michelle Beckering.
In developing countries, it is estimated that 70% of women-owned small and medium-sized businesses are still denied access to the capital they need. Nearly one in two women are shut off from the internet.
In all of our conversations, we're recognizing that technology is the great equalizer. Technology is offering us an acceleration of impact in areas where change has been taking a very long time, said Ms. Beckering. Unfortunately, even as the world becomes ever more digital, women and girls lag far behind boys and men in access to technology, particularly the internet. If you look right now at the gap around the world, 1.7 billion women in the developing world are still unconnected to the internet. And so if you look at the figures, the Intel Corporation has predicted that if you could even bring 600 million women online, that could add an average of between $13 to $18 billion in GDP to 144 developing countries, said Ms. Beckering. Although this is a common problem globally, the reasons for the digital gender gap vary. A recurrent one is high costs of mobile phones and service. In the developing world, some 200 million fewer women than men own a mobile phone, the most common means of internet access there. USAID is looking at solutions to bring down the costs, such as offering two SIM cards for the price of one, and using solar-powered charging stations in off-the-electric grid regions. We are also working with people who live under these conditions who have a lot of great ideas for improvements. USAID, said Senior Coordinator Beckering, is working to break down these barriers to allow women the opportunity to achieve their full potential.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Washington.